what are we trying to achieve if there's just this money mountain that we're trying to get to the top of? I was born, relatively speaking, at the top of that mountain. And it's a lot messier, you know, than we might think it is or would want it to be.
Hello, welcome to Money Honestly, stories about all the ways money can shape a person, for better and for worse. My name is Lionel Foster. Eric Leslie grew up with a big pile of money. It gave him a boost, but it also cast a shadow over generations of his family. With his nonprofit, Union Capital, he's demonstrating how we can leverage financial resources in a different type of currency to make families and communities stronger. One quick note, I met Eric years ago at Johns Hopkins University, so you will hear him reference our alma mater. Here we go.
Eric, welcome. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Let's jump right in. What's your money origin story?
Oh, man. You know, I don't think I've ever been asked the question quite. I share my story a lot, but the money origin story, what comes up for me are two things that we can dig more deeply into. For those listening, you know, might be able to tell, can't quite see, don't want to assume. You know, I'm a middle-aged white guy, cisgender, able-bodied, from Cambridge, Massachusetts. So growing up, I don't remember exactly, but I was about 10 years old, maybe, I think, when the Reebok Pump came out. And those sneakers were everything. Yes. I'm a Boston Celtics fan, grew up here. It was, you know, sometime soon after, then D. Brown was in the slam dunk contest. He pumped up his shoes before dunking and winning the slam dunk contest. And I wanted those sneakers like everybody. You know, and I, you know, there's the Air Jordans and Nike Air, all those things were big too. Didn't have any of those. Wanted the Reebok Pump and didn't get them. It was just my parents were just, they're like, those shoes are way too expensive. And it is fascinating the way inflation works these days. I think they were something like $125, $150. And that's what sneakers are these days as well. Back then, you know, $100+ sneakers, especially for a kid with growing, you know, totally was a dumb thing. I understood, but I interpreted that to somebody like, oh, we don't have the means. Like I have friends who had the pumps. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's something about my parents and the way we're choosing to spend money and to have the things that we have that, you know, we always have food on the table. We always have clothing and what we need, but we must not have the means. But that's only one part of the story because that wasn't the case at all, right? Mm-hmm. I simultaneously was going to private school, paid for through my grandparents, my mom's side, you know, trust fund. Mm-hmm. So I'm a trust fund baby. But I don't know that. And I'm not a material, you know, child. Like I'm not accessing goods and wealth and resources and having all these things at my disposal. And nor is that really being explained to me at 10, 11, 12, 13 years old. It's sort of merging together as I then go to an elite private prep high school. And I'm surrounded by this wealth and cars and resources that I don't have. And yet I do have, you know, this generational wealth.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the origin is that kind of tension and confusion and curiosity that's been passed down through my family.
That is so much to have to sort through as a young teen and a preteen. So you had those questions. Did you get any help sorting through that conundrum?
No, not at all. And something about the culture and of wealth and resources, right? I think it's right to use the word conundrum. Like it wasn't a problem. Like it wasn't like the end of the world. I had, you know, all that was needed in my life afforded to me. There was not a stress about money. And so as a result too, it wasn't a conversation at the dinner table. I think for my parents, you know, kind of classical Northeast white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, you know, it was a sort of a faux pas to discuss money. And as I, you know, grew older and understood more, again, just through family history, but not necessarily always direct conversations, you know, my father was very much grew up in a working class family. He was the first in his family to go to college. His parents were, you know, textile workers, moved around the Northeast, you know, in the mills, eventually ended up in Rhode Island. And his older brother didn't go to college. He went to trade school, got into sales and work. And then he goes to college in the 1960s and is a smart guy. And he had a, you know, some counselor in high school that's like, hey, you should check out Harvard. And lo and behold, he goes to Harvard. And there's a photo of him in high school, you know, graduating high school with like the classic, you know, just kind of like buzz cut, you know, rail thin, you know, thin tie going, you know, graduating high school. And then 4 years later, class of 1969 from Harvard, completely unrecognizable, massive beard, hair to the shoulders, put on some, you know, college weight. He had, you know, he transitioned into this elite world, but without the wealth and access. And then, you know, I share this just in context of what I'm then growing up in, of like, he marries my mom, who, you know, did come from a wealthier background and with this generational wealth being passed on. And so I don't think there was any understanding or an ability to have comfortable conversations about it at the dinner table or with us. As I grew older and prepared to go to college, you know, it was shared and understood that it was through my grandparents' wealth that college was being paid for, that I wouldn't have to apply for loans and need scholarships. But there wasn't a further like understanding of why or what that meant or the privilege that it afforded me. And then I'm in elite high school where that's virtually everybody I'm surrounded by. So they're not necessarily having conversations about money and need and lack of resources or access. And so I'm sort of floating in this confused bubble of like, what do I have? What does that mean for me? And what does that make me?
Where did that trust fund money come from?
So as best as I understood the story, my great grandfather, great great grandfather, somewhere in that lineage on my mom's side, invested in Standard Oil, you know, back at the turn of the 20th century or something, made some savvy investments. But it was Standard Oil was my understanding of where that money that exploded from, and then was passed down to the children, the grandchildren, you know, now it's kind of like the cousins. So I have cousins and aunts and uncles on this, that side that have all sort of carried on with what's been passed down.
So, you know, we are literally barely 7 minutes into the conversation. You talked about a trust fund. You've talked about multiple generations going back to the turn of the 20th century. Are there people in your family who would be uncomfortable, maybe even appalled with how much we're talking out of school about the family money?
I think you're probably right. I think a lot of those people are dead, right? Or are too old to listen to a podcast, I hope. you know, I knowing coming to this conversation, we'd be talking about it. I you know, I'm practicing it as like a space to understand it better. Cause it is not something that comes up in conversations. And I think it's had, you know, such a psychological impact on the family lineage. And again, in sharing this, talking about like the white privilege and the wealth and the aristocracy that this country has created and passed on, that, you know, that impacts people in what ways we would think it's like all for best and all for good. And it's not to say, oh, it's a woe is me, or this is such a lamentable situation. But I don't know, can I use profanity in this podcast?
Go ahead, please.
All right. I meant to ask that before. You know, this wealth really fucked up my mom's side of the family. Suicides, depression, you know, mental health challenges. And interestingly enough, then again, on my mom's side, all the cousins and, you know, now the multi-generational offspring of my generation, I am the only one of six cousins to have children. And that's very much a choice that I, you know, as I understand it, many other the cousins have made. We talk about generational wealth. Well, it's about passing on to the next generation. And as I sit here at age 45, I'm probably going to be the only one that has the next generation. I think it's really fucked things up in my family.
It sounds like you may be making a connection to that wealth, what it's done to people, and some people's decision not to have kids. Can you piece that together for me?
I think I'm still trying to understand it. And again, this is where I think, you know, divulging or invading others' privacy. I have noticed for my mother and her siblings, her two sisters, and then for their children, the wealth, the choice of career and opportunity that was afforded, and this is then for me, as we'll talk about my work and career, the ability to sit and look out in the world and to say, you know, what can I bring to it? What can the world benefit me? How do I give back? How do I show up? And it's, and it, in a good way, it opens up a world of possibilities. And a lot of the people on my mom's side of the family are artists of all different kinds, including my mother. You know, the only job she had was self-employed as a natural wildlife artist, an educator. She's written many books. She's, you know, 78 years old and continues to teach and do art, and she works hard, but not for money. Like, she's not making a living solely on it. And so I think in affording those choices to pursue interests and careers, it also disjoints people of like grounding on kind of societal norms or structures. Like, okay, I got a job, I have kids, I, you know, a pinch and save, and I buy a home, and then I'm passing that home on to my, to the next of kin. And that's just kind of the way things go. That's the American dream, right? You come here, you work hard, you do these things, you know, the thing, all the kind of the lies of meritocracy, that I think, you know, this generational opportunity afforded the family to be above or removed from, but also not then completely understand or give back to, or say, wait a second, this is kind of messed up. Let's give all our money away. There's no, you know, there's no family foundation. There's no donor advised funds. There's no bigger amounts of what, it's kind of just all been sprinkled and chipped away at until people that are like not really working at all are living off of this money to subsist, and they're not having children. So there's no one to really pass the money on to, and then it'll be gone.
I've always been fascinated with people who have had some amount of privilege, have recognized it, owned it, admitted it, and then spoke outside of their circles about the pros and cons of it. Because I just think we need more of that.
I needed it, right? I needed that, and I didn't have that. And for better and worse, that affects me today. And I think there's a real, like, we say, you know, in whatever vernacular we want to say it in, more money, more problems. Mm-hmm. You know, what are those problems? They're not the problems of, you know, making rent at the end of the month, having food on the table, and the fears of how your identity is going to be treated walking into a room or a space. This is all merged, especially when I was in high school in the 1990s, you know, with the era of, quote, like multiculturalism. Mm-hmm. And this like colorblindness and, oh, racism, you know, we have our first black president, it just so happens to be, it's a white man named Bill Clinton. Like, this was a really weird time for race and class consciousness and understanding. And, you know, I was fortunate to get connected with youth organizations that I think were doing a much better job of deconstructing what race and class and privilege meant. And in that time, Peggy McIntosh wrote this short little article that was before things could go viral, but it was printed and photocopied everywhere, called The Invisible Knapsack of Privilege. Mm-hmm. And I was somewhere like 15 or 16 years old when I was in a group session and first saw this list of like 50 items of privilege. And the items were meant to really be so that everybody that reads this list, you know, is going to find at least one thing that they can check. Oh, I do have this privilege, whether it's I have vision, I can hear, I'm able-bodied, all these things. Well, I went through the list of 50 and essentially checked off all of them. And that's, you know, still to this day, you know, a little mind numbing. a couple of the boxes are a little fuzzy, right? One is like I walk into a room where everybody practices the same faith as I do. And I don't practice a faith, but every, you know, they'll be like, oh, you're Christian, right? You're raised in a Christian tradition. I did not go to church, wasn't raised a faith, but yeah, we put up a Christmas tree. And when I walk into spaces, that is, I'm still going to be identified as a WASP. And so, but those privileges are still being afforded to me, even if I'm not ascribing to some of those. And so that was all mixing and merging and understanding, you know, what was the wealth and privilege that I had in all different forms in terms of my identity, in terms of my race, in terms of my able-bodiedness and sexuality and everything else. And it meant I, you know, it led me to get the heck out of Dodge. You know, I left Cambridge, and went far, far away. And of course, not of course, but like so many, ended up back here, you know, 20 years later.
Yeah. We'll get to the coming back in just a minute. Before we do that, so you've got all these thoughts, you know, some fascinating and sometimes difficult family history. And as you mentioned, you have kids. How old are your kids? And how, if at all, do all these thoughts you've been having since the Reebok pump shoes, how does this affect how you raise or interact with your kids?
Oh, man, I love that question. My daughters are 13, and so 7th grade, and 10, and 4th grade. And so they're right at that same age for me of like kind of understanding the resources and needs. And I'd say my wife and I are intentional having better conversations with them. But, you know, we have not yet sat down with them to say, hey, here are the kind of, here's the trust that's being passed on. And it's, it, and each, you know, generation, it kind of gets further and further constricted. And so we're not talking about millions of dollars. We're talking about enough to, you know, ideally, hopefully be able to pay for them to go to college. So again, that kind of thing. And not sure how much is going to be left after that, given the cost of college these days. Depends on where they go and if they go. But again, in terms of the day-to-day resources and needs, you know, we have a house with a mortgage where the, you know, food, the fridge is full, you know, and lights are on and clothes are provided, et cetera. We made a choice, and one that I think really was also a financial choice that based on our circumstances, that our children go to public schools. And so they're not, we're not kind of paying out major costs on things. We have one car, one house. We're pretty limited in those means as well. So it's like history is repeating itself of sorts, similar to my parents. So I'm laughing because my older daughter right now is 13. She is saving up to buy a Nintendo Switch because we're not buying one for her. Right?
Could we? Suddenly is like, so, I mean, the Nintendo's heyday was in the 80s. Switch.
Same thing.
Yeah, man.
So I wanted a Nintendo too. So the Reebok pump was one. The Nintendo was the other. And that was shorter lived because my friend got one and I was over his house a lot and I sucked. So I kind of gradually lost interest in wanting a Nintendo, but it was that similar, like, how much was the Nintendo when it came out back then? It was a couple $100 respect, you know, that's inflationary, yeah. Right? We're talking about like $1,000 today or something. I believe this Nintendo Switch that she's saving up for is $300. And it's in it because like she could like beg and request that this is her birthday present or a Christmas gift. And I think we could be convinced to buy that for her, but she is not used to getting gifts of that value.
Yeah.
And so this is a stretch that she recognizes she has to earn and get. Yeah. And so she gets a little bit of an allowance and she's learning how to manage that. And it's all digital, right? So she's got a online account that comes with a debit card and she's, you know, saving that money. And I think she's got about $200. So wow. It's going to take her, you know, several more months to get there, but she'll get that Nintendo Switch.
Tell us about Union Capital.
So in the context of this story, I think Union Capital is the best and probably, you know, kind of convoluted, twisted, challenged approach that I have to living with this wealth and privilege. It's not a vanity project because it's pretty I don't wouldn't necessarily make me look better doing it. It's quite a struggle of an effort to pull off after 11 years. But it is a new thinking in a way to value and create community power. And power comes in many forms in terms of people, but also in terms of money. And the spark of the idea that we built on 11 years ago is that time is valuable. And so for people that have less means, giving of that time, whether it's being at your child's school or community event or engaging in civic, political life, is costly. And yet we have that expectation that people of all walks of life, you should vote, you should engage in community efforts, and you should be at your child's back to school night. Should. But it is so expensive to be poor in this country, and to then have these expectations of engagement is then coupled with that engagement is actually immensely valuable.
Yeah.
Right? Upwards of 80% of all jobs in the United States are obtained through personal relationships and networks. We know that adage of it's not necessarily what you know, but who you know. That's what college really is measured in its value. You pay to go to Harvard. The education is questionable. It's as good as, a community college in many ways, depending on how much you put into it. It's the network that you're buying into, that you're connecting into, be it Johns Hopkins or anywhere else. It's who you know. And so if you don't have the means, if you don't have the time, if you don't have the relationships, mathematically, if you know less people and you're connected to less people, those opportunities are going to be less. That's social capital. And it isn't just about job attainment. Communities that have higher rates of volunteerism, public meeting attendance, helping of neighbors, have statistically significant higher rates of employment gain, but also voter participation, financial wellness, health outcomes, on and on, all these measures. So union capital is my best attempt to disrupt that. And it's a rewards program for community and civic engagement, in which we are inviting people in Boston, Massachusetts, now also in Springfield, Massachusetts, from organizations and from communities of color and that have been historically under-resourced, marginalized, and oppressed, to get engaged in public life, to come out to our meetings and gatherings, go to community trainings and workshops, to volunteer at your child's school, to help a neighbor in need, go grocery shopping, and to get a little bit of money back. I wouldn't say it's a wealth transfer, but it's a bit of a money transfer. Mm-hmm. We're printing money on Visa gift cards and distributing it out to people for the hours that they take to engage. And over this 10 plus years, we have printed and distributed over $2.4 million on Visa gift cards to our members. When you average that out, it's about $200 per member per year. So it's not paying the rent. It's not generating wealth. But in terms of what was passed on to me, it's way more money than I have, in those trust accounts. And in a way, it's kind of like me figuring out how can I transfer and seed wealth and money in a different way to generate greater power and outcomes. I don't know if that's the best way to do it, but trying to figure it out.
So let me kind of frame union capital in my understanding and check this with you. Part of what I think about, there are so many pro-social activities that for a while have been expected in America, but have been totally individualized. So I think about classic suburban 1950s, maybe a white family. You have a so-called breadwinner, and then you have a homemaker who's also part of the PTA, maybe part of the neighborhood association, just doing so much to make the household and the community function. What union capital is saying, that is labor, that is valuable. It needs to be recognized and rewarded. That time is expensive. Let's honor that. Let's recognize that and give more people access to it for the benefit of their households and the entire community.
Nailed it. And what I'll add to it, right, is that there's been a ton of research done about this decline of social capital. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just bizarre, this MAGA era, but like what is this creating an era? And there's something in the 1950s for white middle class and upper middle class people that just like this bygone era that was, full of domestic violence and alcoholism and racism and sex. I mean, just all these terrible things. But there's something about this era. And I think it goes to that picture that you kind of touched on there of the homemaker engaged in the community, supporting the children, being involved in public life, and there being resources and opportunities that flowed from it. What I hearken back to is also in the 1950s, the Montgomery bus boycott was entirely built off of this social capital as well, right? In a oppressed community and forced segregation and you know, Jim Crow conditions, the Black community said, enough. And we are connected through our churches, through our schools, through our neighborhoods with each other, not just to, you know, have Saturday hangouts or whatever is going on in the white middle class, you know, block parties, but to mass protest and demonstrate and not ride the bus, to boycott the bus, you know, for a year and a half, and to withstand and overcome the violence, the arrests, the oppression, and to win, right? To dismantle Jim Crow segregation with the power that they built in these community networks. Those networks do not exist in the same way today in right. this country, right. in any class structure. And that's devastating for us. And I think speaks to the rise of this fear-mongering MAGA hatred that's out there.
2 minutes ago, when you were problematizing the fetishization of that white middle to upper income suburban family from the 1950s, there was a lot that was wrong there. I suspect that part of the attraction, part of why some people are hearkening back to that, is because the roles people played were very clear.
Isn't it?
The man was supposed to be the breadwinner. The wife, and of course, this was in an era when, you know, queer people and social and family structures were not nearly as respected. Yep. Some of them were demonized. But so I'm just talking in the terms that were more standard then.
Yep.
The roles were clear. This is what the children would do. The wife, the mom. This is what, you know, maybe if you lived in a certain town, you might know who the bank president was. You might actually know the person who was underwriting your loan. And I think there's a hunger for that, kind of clarity. Your Union Capital is investing in people having very important roles in their community. So can you speak to that part? Are people coming into themselves? How are people finding one another in community?
Yeah. No, I appreciate you asking that. Because again, I think like there's all these things in the 1950s and the 60s as well that financially enabled that reality too, because of the post-World War II economy and the GI Bill and all these other things that you could have one breadwinner, right? You could buy a home and you didn't have the gig economy. You didn't have to have like, oh, you're 14, time to go get a job and get to work too. Like, our economy is so, so different and so distressed now that, yeah, what we're seeking imperfectly is to have a program that is speaking to all the stages of Maslow's hierarchy of need. So most nonprofit organizations, whether they know it or identify it as not, are going to be working on one strand of that, right? At the base level of the hierarchy of needs is food, shelter, and safety, right? And so you have the organizations that are getting a bed for the night, getting, food distributed, domestic violence survivorship, all these like survival-based things. And we're a piece of that, right? That there's money and resources and you come to our meetings and there's a hot meal. There's a bit of that bottom end. But as you work your way up that hierarchy of needs into more of a supporting the next generation, sense of purpose and direction of impact and legacy, what we're seeking to support and spark is that the money, which is again small, up to $500 a year, so you're not taxed on it. You don't face the cliff effect of cuts of benefits. You don't need to be documented either. The money gets you in the door for that greater self-actualization. And it might just simply be, I learn about a great summer camp for my program because I came to this community meeting and now my child is out sailing on the Charles River and then they go on to a career in oceanography. I don't know, right? But like that access to things that you wouldn't have otherwise had. And then at the highest levels, as we invest and train grassroots community leaders, is that they start their own initiatives and efforts, that they launch their own organizations, their own businesses, that they run for office, and that they collectively build the power of that community. So some of our founding members are now Boston City Councilors, in the State House, state senators, our founding board member. And then you have the neighborhood, council folks or parent task force presidents, people who take on different roles. And we're not singularly solely focused on that. We're not like a civic campaign shop. We're not training people to take those specific actions, but we're intending to connect and seed that. And the money, right, is hopefully a hook. It's an invitation, it's a spark, and it's a means to this greater end.
How does Union Capital determine which types of activities will get people credit towards some of that capital?
So I love this question because I had the best idea of how that should be awarded, and it turned out to be completely wrong. And so I love to tell this story about being wrong, which was, as we were designing this and piloting this, I thought that, there should be different tiers and something should be worth more than others, right? If you were, doing something for yourself in the community, you're going to a financial credit workshop, that's great. You can get 100 points an hour. You're doing something for your children and you're volunteering at the child's school. Okay, that's something you're kind of doing for your family. That's even better. That's 200 points an hour. And then you're doing something that's completely altruistic. You're at a food, clothing or food distribution program. You're giving out food and clothing. That's incredible. That's 300 points an hour. You should somehow tier it that way. And we had a leadership committee team that I built with people piloting the program and from, representative organizations that we were working with us on. And one of them, Wilbur, who's still a leader with us now, a tremendous guy who started his own nonprofit, just shot the idea down immediately and so effectively. He's like, Eric, you are, no matter how you do this, you're going to then be ascribing your cultural values to what should be awarded and not. And you could distill it, education is more important than health, I think, right? So I'm going to award more for education now. And I'm going to become, a little, grumpy Wizard of Oz trying to turn levers behind a curtain. And he was absolutely right. And so the thing that he said, he's like, the one thing we all have equally is time. And that's probably the only thing in this world that we all share equally is 1 hour is 1 hour. And we should award that. So whether you are the person attending the meeting, falling asleep in the back and you're there for an hour, or you're the person up on stage leading and organizing and hosting the meeting, you're both there for an hour. You both are at 100 points an hour. And basically, if you're doing anything that's, you're not getting paid to do, so you can't earn points for doing a job, that you're doing with others and that's non-family. So it's not like you're taking your kid to the movies, but if you organize a bunch of neighborhood kids and take them to the movies, you're doing it with others. This is prior to the pandemic, we were very explicit saying it has to be app-based outside of your home. Mm-hmm. And that changed with the virtual world, but you're doing something with others, like virtually or outside of your home. No matter what it is, you earn points for it. So if you go on a walking group with neighbors, you're out of your home, you're doing it with others, you're not getting paid for it. That's building our community and you get rewarded.
You've either invented a currency or simply surfaced a currency and utilized it to great effect. What do you want other people to know about this type of currency, how powerful it can be, what they might be able to do with it?
I'm glad you asked that, because something that is, since the beginning of this, that's been understandable but extremely frustrating for me, and it continues to this day, is like, some people are just going to do this for the money, they're going to lie, they're going to cheat, they're just doing this, they're going to, you go on your phone, you enter in, I went to this program, click, and I get points, and then I get a little bit of money. People should be doing this because they want to do it, and this kind of classist, disconnected understanding about time and privilege. Mm-hmm. And some of that's true. And that's okay. Like, I think in understanding how we're all motivated, that we do things for extrinsic and intrinsic reasons simultaneously.
Yeah.
All right. When I go vote, I vote because I care about voting and democracy. But I remember one time when I went to go vote, they were out of the I voted stickers. And I noticed how disappointed I was that I didn't get a sticker. And I had to walk around all day seeing all these other stickers and people look at me and be like, hey, I don't think you voted, you know? And that sticker has value. It has currency. I didn't vote for the sticker, but I want the sticker. And for our members and for all of us in our lives, there's that myriad of reasons, right? Like, I've got to fly somewhere, but you're going to tell me I can get frequent flyer miles and eventually get a free flight? Yeah, I didn't fly to that destination to get the miles, but I'm not going to be a sucker and not take the miles either. There's a mixture in understanding how we're all motivated and how we're all grounded, and that there is, again, this cost trade-off that we don't think more holistically about. And I think there's more growing and, you know, and a much greater level of understanding, like universal basic income and guaranteed income and how that can impact and affect people's choices. And the same critique of like, people are going to use that money to do terrible things. It's like every time they read, you know, people use that money to buy food, to get clothes for their kids, take care of their family. We're going to use the money in a way that best benefits us. And if that means sometimes that we are stretching the truth, or we went to a meeting for an hour and we said we were really there for 3 hours, okay, a couple more quarters that folks have earned. And it's about the larger, these larger goals that we have.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Eric. Is there anything I should have asked you that I didn't?
I mean, I'm a talker, so there's things that I could add in. I appreciate the context of the conversation. You know, I think there's those bridge of years for me from high school to starting Union Capital to where I live now. That has been a continual adventure of understanding identity, right? And intersectionality. I'm so grateful for conversations like this because I often will, you know, I will always identify who I am and the privilege of my background is, but not necessarily speak to the stories behind it, because who cares, right? I think, you know, it's like for people who have lived, you know, lives of challenge and of lesser means, of oppression, and have historical legacies through their families of being, you know, brought to this country through enslavement or through, you know, strife and conditions and war and immigration. You know, who wants to hear my story about, you know, a trust fund passed on? But I do think that there are, you know, lessons that I want to share and that I continue to try to learn. And I think it can open up new ways that we think about this. You know, what is the objective that we have as a country? Like, the way capitalism works is not everyone is going to be millionaires. And one study I saw is one of the reasons so many people are opposed to like taxes on millionaires is not because they are a millionaire, but because they think and aspire one day that they will be.
Yeah.
And they don't want that future money that they never are going to get to be taxed. And they don't ever become millionaires. But what are we trying to achieve if there's just all this money mountain that we're trying to get to the top of? I can generally say that my mom's side of the family and me as a result of it, I was born, relatively speaking, at the top of that mountain. And it's a lot messier, you know, than we might think it is or would want it to be. And if we're not, you know, it's not to say then people shouldn't get to the top. I mean, it's not me saying get off the mountain. Like, who am I to say don't aspire to that or get there, but learn from it. And how does it pass on to the next generation that you've got these means, you have these opportunities, you have these privileges. How might you show up in the world? How do you give back? How do you speak and understand about it? And how do you, you know, carry that as a opportunity and as a burden? I mean, white guilt is a term and exists for a reason. And that's something that I've carried and I continue to digest and understand. And it's not just white guilt. It's, you know, male guilt. It's tall height guilt. It's whatever, you know, it's all the guilt of these privileges that I can check off. And I think the conversations are the, you know, a way to and through that. So I appreciate you making the space for it.
You're very welcome. I feel like there might be a part two. because
hey, I'd love that.
You have such rich experience and you're good at speaking into a microphone. Thanks again.
Thank you, Leno.
Music for Money Honestly is courtesy of bassist, composer, and band leader Chris Fun. It's his song Wish from the album Corner Store.